The line between bold and reckless is very thin, and it's usually only known with hindsight. There's a long history of entrepreneurs who are very good at getting rich, but they don't have the related skill of staying rich. The same personality trait that made them so successful is the one that can eventually push them over the edge.
When it comes to money, how much is enough? Turns out the answer to that question is less about data, statistics, or return on investment, and more about psychology. Certainly when his best-selling book, The Psychology of Money, came out, author Morgan Housel seemed to strike a collective nerve. Morgan, thanks for joining me. Firstly, congratulations on the new book, Same As Ever. I'd love to start with your thoughts about where we are right now. Are people feeling stressed, indifferent, or upbeat about money?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I think it's always the case that people will anchor to their own unique past of what they've experienced. And obviously, if you look all in the United States and all over the world, what people have experienced, particularly over the last 4 years, during and coming out of COVID, has been so varied. I mean, think about a restaurant owner whose business shut down for a year or two during COVID, during the pandemic, and compare that to a tech worker who's had probably the most prosperous and job security that they've had ever in their life over the last 4 years. Completely different experiences. So however people feel about the economy and where they see the economy going is heavily anchored to what they have experienced in their own unique life. And those experiences are probably as varied today as they've ever been.
And one of the stories you tell in your first book is about the world's greatest investor, Warren Buffett, and the power of compounding. What can everyone learn from Warren Buffett?
The craziest statistic about Warren Buffett is if you look today, he's worth roughly $120 billion, something in that neighborhood. About $117 billion of that, the vast, vast majority, came after his 60th birthday. You know, well over 90%, 95%, even 98% came during his elderly years. Is he a good investor? Yes, of course he is. But the real secret is that he's been a good investor for 80 years at this point. It's just the amount of time that he's been doing it for. And that's really important because if he had retired at age 60, like a normal person might, you would have never heard of him. No one would have ever heard of the guy. The whole reason that he is so successful and has generated this amount of wealth is because he's been doing it for so long. The time is the secret in there. And that's so important for all investors because we spend, as an industry, so much time and effort trying to pick apart how he's done it and what his skills are. And we go into how he thinks about businesses and moats and management teams, and that's all very important. But the real takeaway that people can actually try to emulate and try to put into practice for themselves is just the endurance and longevity and time horizon that he's put into it.
Now, if we consider a younger billionaire, Elon Musk, there is a very thin line between inspiringly bold and foolishly reckless. How big of a role does luck and risk play in building and maintaining wealth?
I've always thought that Elon Musk is either going to be the world's first trillionaire or he'll be bankrupt. It's going to be one or the two. And maybe that's a better way to summarize that the line between bold and reckless is very thin. And it's usually only known with hindsight. People like Musk are taking just huge, enormous risks. And I think the personality characteristic that will make someone like Musk so successful, whether that's thinking that the rules don't apply to him or having a view of risk that he has that virtually no one else does, are the exact same personality characteristics and traits that push people over the edge. So getting rich and staying rich are very different skills. And obviously to date, Musk has done both. He's done very well, but there's a long history of entrepreneurs who are very good at getting rich, very good at solving problems, very good at building products, but they don't have the related skill of staying rich. The same personality trait that made them so successful is the one that can eventually push them over the edge. I think luck and risk really are the same factors, the same influences, just in the opposite direction. What's important in investing is that throughout the industry, so many people think about risk all day long. They'd hire risk consultants and do risk-adjusted returns. Like, risk is the center of investing. And luck is almost completely ignored. I think if luck is kind of a dirty word that people don't want to talk about, the better phrasing of it that just has a little bit better connotation is, what can I repeat? What is something that happened in the past that led to a certain degree of success that I can actually replicate in the future? And there are a lot of those things that you can't. It was the right place at the right time, a certain condition, a certain act that you were able to take that you cannot repeat in the future. So back to Warren Buffett, who we were talking about before, I cannot replicate or repeat a lot of the opportunities that he had back in the 1960s and 70s when he was making most of his money. But can I at least try to replicate the endurance that he's had, the longevity that he's put into his portfolio? I can at least try to do that. It's something that I can actually do rather than trying to rely on something that may have been closer to luck.
And one of the other things that you explore in the book is the divide between the uber wealthy and the poor, which is only getting bigger. What's the risk with inequality becoming more and more pronounced?
There's no such thing as an objective measure of wealth. Everything is just relative to other people. So when you look around, you're comparing yourself to other people. And when you have a very, very extremely wealthy portion of the economy, it's easy for everyone else to anchor their expectations to that. And so when you have this sliver of society that's extremely wealthy, it can inflate the aspirations of everyone else. And then when you have an economy like that, you find yourself in a situation where the median income can grow, the median household net worth can improve, and people don't feel any better off for it because they are anchoring to a small sliver of society whose lifestyle and wealth has exploded by an astronomical degree. So even if it's a very normal, it has a negative impact on how people feel about how they're doing financially. I think there's also a risk, and this is more political than it is economic, where you don't want to get in a situation in the economy where, let's say, a third of society wakes up every morning and says, this isn't working for me. They look around and they say, look, I'm working as hard as anyone else, but they're doing so much better than me. Not just a little bit better than me, but 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times better than me. If you get enough of society that just wakes up and thinks that the system doesn't work for them anymore, that's not a position that any economy wants to find itself in. That's when things start to go off the train tracks.
Well, also under the current economic condition, you have income growing, but not growing as fast as inflation, unfortunately. Now, there's also the issue of expectation versus the reality. How does this play out if people don't have as much money as they expect that they should?
On average, most people are doing much better than they were 25 years ago or a century ago. They're doing much better than they were, but they don't necessarily feel that way because their expectations rose in lockstep with their income, with their prosperity. And I think that's a fundamental fact of how humans work. It's always been like that and always will be, that expectations reset in lockstep with prosperity in a way that leaves you feeling no better off. And so I think at the societal level, it's always going to be like that. It has always been like that. It's kind of a tough thing to come to grips with, but that's what it is. I think at the individual level, there are some people who can go out of their way to manage their expectations with as much emphasis as they do their income and their circumstances. And once you realize that, it's really just the gap between the two, the gap between your income and your expectations, that's going to create the satisfaction and happiness with money. Once you come to terms with that, then I think the game that we're all playing financially comes into more starker terms.
And they could probably come to terms with that if the affordability of housing is something that was more attainable as well, which seems to be should be very fundamental to people's well-being. Now let's check in with our resident economist, Alex Holmes. Alex, Morgan's book, The Psychology of Money, suggests we're not all hyper-rational beings when it comes to finances. Has this concept ever made its way into the field of economics?
Thanks, Pamela. In short, yes, it has. So much of the economic literature is built upon the idea that people behave rationally, at least on average. But the work of the late Daniel Kahneman, the only psychologist to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, suggests otherwise. His work in the 70s and 80s really shook the core of the profession, with clever experiments demonstrating that we can be subject to predictable, general, and persistent irrationality. There are many examples, but some of the most famous are things like loss aversion. We tend to weight losses far, far higher than symmetrically sized gains. Or there's the fact that we tend to overestimate small possibilities, especially when they're related to catastrophic outcomes. All these things govern how we view and manage risk, and hence the financial decisions we take. And bringing this back to themes close to Morgan's current book, psychology also plays an important role in a newer vein of economics, that's studying happiness and life satisfaction. Experiments have shown that people's happiness is not just related to absolute wealth and spending power, but how they measure up against others. This even holds when you zoom out and look at things at the macro level. Let's compare across countries. Europe tends to be the most egalitarian, in contrast to somewhere like the US, where the top 1% of earners take home around twice the share of income as the whole bottom 50%. Countries with much lower average incomes than the US, such as Slovakia or Slovenia, for instance, have much higher happiness scores. They just happen to have far lower wealth disparities. Perhaps it all comes down to the haves and have-nots. If you're surrounded by people that mostly reflect your circumstances, you feel like you're doing okay in life and therefore pretty happy with what you have.
Thank you very much, Alex. Now, Morgan, in your second book, you talk about a very deeply personal story about your two friends who were caught in an avalanche. Their lives were tragically cut short, but in stark contrast, you've gone on to become a best-selling author. And I imagine this gives you some incredible perspective on the role of luck. Do people underestimate luck in either success or in failure?
The late economist Daniel Kahneman, who just passed away just a couple of days ago, he had this saying that always stuck with me. He said, in any degree of outsized success, when you are like many standard deviations away from the norm, there is always a degree of luck that's in there. And a lot of times the factor of luck that's playing out here is just where and when you happen to be born. So look at someone like Bill Gates or LeBron James or Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk, any of these people. Are they brilliant? Are they hardworking? Are they visionaries? Yes, of course. Were they also kind of in the right place at the right time, so to speak? Like, yes, there's that too. And so it's easy to overestimate the factors that go into it. If Warren Buffett or Bill Gates were born in Africa 100 years ago, nobody should pretend that they would have anywhere near the kind of success that they otherwise did. So I think when you look at luck, it's not black and white. It's not either you have it or you don't. There's always a degree of it that's playing a role. And the more success that you have, the more there is some element of luck or just an element of something that cannot be repeated than you would have in other circumstances.
You also talk a lot about your own financial security. What is this worth to you, not just from a financial perspective, but from your own sense of well-being and personal satisfaction?
I've always thought my only financial goal personally is independence and freedom and autonomy. It's less about what I can buy and more just the ability to do what I want, when I want, with whom I want, for as long as I want. And I think that's the highest dividend that money can pay. And I think most people's knee-jerk reaction, of course, is what if you ask them, what is money for? They say it's to buy stuff, of course. And of course, that is the great thing. But I think one of the things that it buys that is easy to overlook is that independence and autonomy. And that is what unspent money does. Wealth that's just sitting in your brokerage account, the wealth, your net worth that you're building up. It's not necessarily that you're saving up to buy something. It's that having that unspent money is what gives you independence and autonomy. And that is, I think, a universal factor of happiness. Some people like huge homes. Some people like fast cars. Everyone's preference is different. But almost everyone likes freedom and independence and autonomy. So if you can use your money to buy yourself time and control your calendar, control your schedule, that's always been the most appealing to me. And I think that's actually a pretty universal thing that people like with money.
Agree with that wholeheartedly. Now, you've spoken about a simmering discontent, particularly in America, that's been being driven by the divide between the uber wealthy and the lowest 50% of earners. How do you see this dynamic playing out internationally?
If you're talking about internationally, I think it's actually less important than the local level, because most people will compare themselves to their neighbors and their coworkers and their siblings and people in their local town. And that's changed a little bit with social media, where now we're comparing ourselves to a much broader group of people than we ever have before. But I think at the international level, it impacts people less than it does at the local level. Really, the core of inequality is about social comparison. And people compare themselves to who they think at least are their closest peers. So obviously at the international level, it is a much starker level of inequality. And there are people watching this who, you know, are living lives that other people in the world could not even comprehend. But who you're comparing yourself to tends to be those who are closest around you.
And in this context, in the U.S., someone like Donald Trump is speaking to the lowest 50% of earners and he's getting traction. Why is this happening?
Well, I think it's always true that politicians that do well are the ones who tell people what they want to hear. And I think that's no different whether it's Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Joe Biden. That's always been the case. I do think it's the case that whether not necessarily the bottom 50% of people, but the people who feel like for whatever reason that they are doing very poorly financially are going to be the ones who are most attuned to the messages that they want to hear. And it's always been the case that a politician who tells you that better times are ahead in the economy and in the whole nation are going to get people's attention. So I think what we're seeing necessarily is not necessarily anything new. And if you study the long history of politics, I think what's going on right now, it's a different cast of characters, but it's really the same movie that we've seen over and over again.
And making big macro changes at the U.S. state level is obviously going to take a lot more time. But at the household level, what can people do to improve their wealth, reduce their risk, and feel happier about their own situation?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that the purpose of money is not necessarily to maximize returns. For most people, what they actually want out of it is to maximize how well they sleep at night. And using money as a tool to give yourself a better life is very different than using money as a benchmark to compare yourself by to others. And one thing that's really important here is just the realization and the observation that expectations plays just as big a role in your happiness with money as your circumstances do. And that's probably the most important thing to do. Most people, obviously, you can't control what the stock market's going to do next. You can't control what the economy is going to do next. One of the things that you can control the most are your expectations. That's what most people should pay the most attention to.
And what would you say is your parting wisdom on this topic beyond just utilizing money as a tool to buy freedom, flexibility, and options? What's the takeaway here?
I think one of the most important things with money, maybe the biggest takeaway, is that there is no single one right way to do it. That what you want out of money is going to be different than what I want out of money. Not because one of us is less informed or not as smart as the other. It's just everyone's different. Everyone has a different background, which is going to give them different goals, different social aspirations. So you have to really look in the mirror and try to figure out what works for you, even if that doesn't work for other people who are around you, and realize that personal finance is more personal than it is finance.
Very personal. Now, a big thank you to our special guest, Morgan Housel, best-selling author of Psychology of Money and Same as Ever, and our resident expert economist, Alex Holmes. Thank you both. And thanks for tuning in to episode 7 of I See Your Trade, season 4. I See Your Trade is brought to you by IC Markets, a leading high-performance trading provider. Trade up to IC Markets. Thanks for joining us today. And remember, you can watch and listen back the episodes from the past 3 seasons on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. See you next time.